You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 10th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And we have a special guest rogue this week, Stephen Barnes. Steve, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. I'm excited to be here.
So Evan is out because it's, you know, almost April 15th, and he is completely buried in taxes.
And Stephen is in, right?
And Stephen is in, right. So it was a good week to have a guest rogue in because we're short one rogue to begin with. So Steve, tell us a little bit about yourself.
And why are you here, by the way? I think people would like to know that.
I'm here, like I said, because Evan has to do the unfortunate thing of taxes, which I just finished mine, and oh my gosh, what a disaster. Have you guys all done your taxes yet?
Yep. I just finished today, and I always feel like I'm going to get audited, you know? I'm like, oh my God, is this correct? I'm trying my best.
Yeah, I ran down the stairs, I was done. I'm like, I'm done! It was like the victory lap that it had to take. But anyway, I've been a supporter of the show for a while, and I appreciate you guys giving me the opportunity to come on. It's kind of interesting. I discovered your show because I decided to build my own board game, which I don't know if I've told you guys about the board game I made, Conspiracy Theory.
Yeah.
Yeah, you did.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you did. Conspiracy Theory. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. You guys, and I think especially you guys of my vintage will appreciate what I did in it because of the embedded little hidden sci-fi and other things that I've been in the answers. But yeah, I have a friend that is a flat earther, reptilian, New World Order, birther, truther. And she's always giving me stuff. And I made a joke a couple years ago that I said, well, you know, somebody should make a trivia game. I was at a party and they're like, well, why don't you do it? I was like, okay. So I started doing the investigations, and I realized that the world is full of a lot more crazy people than I thought. And during that time, one of the things I came across was the SGU podcast, and I immediately just resonated with all the stuff that y'all did. And my Texas is coming out. And became a fan of the show. And then when you started the Patreon and had the options for us to join and support it, I have jumped on that chance and been a supporter ever since. And
awesome.
Yeah.
And what's your day job?
My day job is I'm a sales guy. I'm an old engineer, and I'm now selling for telecommunications. So it's what I do. And I also but my board game is growing. I've sold over 10,000 copies of it. I've added a new expansion pack, and we're going to be adding 4 or 5 more titles this year. So that's actually becoming another job just because of a joke, but still. And you guys are great research,
by
the way. One of my greatest conspiracies is the one that you guys came up with, I think, a couple of months ago, where the algae that eats plants proved that there are psychic vampires. which I did, by the way, add to my expansion pack. So,
awesome.
That one's amazing. The line of logic from algae to vampire was so clear.
Seamless.
I don't know why I didn't see it right away. But, you know.
I know.
Anyway, but yeah, thanks again for having me here.
Our pleasure.
But I want to thank you for contributing to the SGU. You're one of the people that made it possible for me to work full time for this company that I love so much. I feel like in a lot of weird ways that this thing is just starting. You know what I mean? We've been doing the podcast for freaking how many years now, Steve? 14
It'll be
years?
14 in a couple weeks.
Yep. And we're still all invigorated and love doing it and love meeting our patrons. So thank you very much.
Oh, no, I tell you, I've been really excited. I was excited when the opportunity came, and I'm really excited for you. Congratulations, Jay, for getting involved with this, because I know how much work is involved behind the scenes, and I think that the SGU does a lot of really important work, especially in some of the, a lot of the conspiracies like I research are just harmless, Bigfoot and stuff, but things like anti-vaccine, homeopathy, they cause real harm to people. And I found the SGU, I've used a lot of your arguments in talking to those kind of folks, and I bet a lot of people around the world have been. So I think the work that you do is very important.
So we have a very important announcement.
Mm-hmm.
We're all very excited about it. So a lot of talk has been going on behind the scenes. Now, this year is another year that the SGU is going to travel down under. We're going to be going to New Zealand And in New Zealand, there is a conference on the weekend of November 29th to December 1st. It'll be in the South Island. This is the New Zealand Skeptics that are running this conference. And then a short week later, we will be over in Melbourne to do yet another conference in Australia. This will be our third time going to Australia.
Wait, Melbourne? Melbourne?
Yeah, he did it right. Good job.
All right, just checking.
Wait, it's not Melbourne?
No, that's very
Melbourne.
Well, that's how everybody. What's funny is everybody outside of Australia says Melbourne, or you know, but the locals say Melbourne, and that's what they want us to say, and that's what we will say. This is Skepticon 2019. This will be on the 6th to the 8th of December, and this is cool because I've never been to Melbourne. I can't wait to go, and we're going to No, I haven't been.
I love it.
I've been to Cairns, and I've been to, of course, Sydney. And we went to the capital as well, which was
Canberra.
Awesome. Canberra was awesome. That was such a great time. Like 2 days.
I don't know. I think of all the Australian cities, because I've been to both of those and Perth. And I got to say, I think Melbourne's my favorite city. No offense to people in other big cities. But yeah, because it's like a chill, cool place to hang out. Like, I really like the vibe there. I think you guys are going to enjoy it a lot.
Lots of beards. Is that what you're saying?
There are some beards. It does not have beards.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good to know.
And I agree with you, Kara. I've been to both the Sydney and Melbourne, and Melbourne is just laid back. Sydney's very metropolitan. Like, I didn't have – my best clothes aren't good enough to wear in Sydney. And, and Melbourne is much more Texas-like, where people are just kind of hanging back. And it's where I had kangaroo, which I'm never going to eat again, but at least I tried it.
Yeah. Me too. I tried it in Melbourne too.
We tried alligator and something else.
Emu.
Yeah.
Emu was terrible.
And kangaroo.
Yeah, that's what they just said.
Emo was also on the menu, but none of us dared try that.
There were emu balls. I don't mean testicles. I mean like meatballs made of emu meat.
Yeah.
Can I say that it was terrible?
Yeah,
I like that you're all saying emu, because there's this commercial for this weird muscle cream that I see all the time, and they're like emu cream, and every time they say it, it makes me a little twitchy.
It's like an ice pick in my friggin' heart. Yeah.
All right, so before we lose track here, you can go to skepticon.org.au to check out the Melbourne conference. The New Zealand Skeptics will have something up soon. They are just finalizing some details. I do recommend you go to the site if you're interested, because they're looking for papers. They have a list of important dates, like an important date here is early bird tickets will start to be sold on June 1st for the Melbourne conference. So you need to keep up with these things. We'll be letting you know as more information comes in. But we are going to be there, and we are going to be all over those two countries. Like nobody's business.
Well, the New Zealand, this time it's in the South Island. Last time we were only in the North Island. But it's definitely going to be on the South Island. And that's where the Lord of the Rings was shot mostly.
That's correct. And there is also a secret thing that Steve, Bob, and I are doing.
Yeah, very super secret, but awesome.
In the North Island, yes. We might drop some more hints as time goes on.
On a completely unrelated random topic, Jay, Bob, and I are also developing a Star Trek phaser rifle with our awesome friend David, who works with Weta. And this is cool. So this is a part of our side project, Alpha Quadrant 6, where a lot of people say, hey, will you guys review some more science fiction movies and stuff? We are. We're doing it every week. It's over at Alpha Quadrant 6. Take a listen.
I love them for this, guys.
Yeah.
Take it all out of SGU onto a whole other podcast.
Yeah.
And as part – so on HQ6, we actually have done our first preliminary mock-up of what we want the phaser rifle to look like. So David is a builder, and he's incredible. And so he and some of the other design people over at Weta are going to build a freaking, you know, real like movie quality Star Trek phaser rifle for us. We're going to document the whole thing. Completely unrelated to our super secret project that we're doing.
And there is a secret thing about what Steve just said. With more information will come back later. That might actually involve you, the listeners.
Yeah, so it's true.
We have an awesome year this year, I'm telling you. I wish I could just spill everything, but we have so many fun things already planned and awesome events and stuff going on. Another quickie event that we'd like to say is the No Show. Steve, talk about the No Show.
The No Show is going to be a day of skeptical awesomeness. So there is a LARP at noon, which is sold out. Sorry if you didn't make that. But then we're doing a live recording of the SGU. George is doing a concert, and then we're going to do an extravaganza in the evening. It's a full day of fun. It's in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. It's with George Robb, and the whole SGU will be there. There are still a few seats left.
April 26th, and you can go to noshow.eventbrite.com for all the details. And yep. Then last but not least, don't forget, there is Nexus coming up this summer, necss.org.
But before all of that happens, we're going to do some news items. We're going to start with, have you guys heard of this? Quantum acupuncture.
What?
I'm just,
oh, no.
I love it.
So, Steve, later in the show, you're going to be talking about a quantum engine, which is sort of real, but this is quantum acupuncture. So I'm talking about this because, not because a study was just published promoting quantum acupuncture, but because that study was just retracted. It was published in 2017. And somehow slipped under my radar, but probably because it was published in some obscure Chinese journal. But, you know, it had its impact. It made the rounds. And now the journal was basically shamed into retracting it. In their retraction statement, they're as vague could be. You know what I mean? Like they say, they just talk about basic principles. We decided that it was in the best interest of blah, 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 but they don't mention any details about specifically why they're retracting it. And the reason I think basically is just because it's stupid. You know, I mean, the paper is just dumb, but what is it? So it's just like you think. I mean, if you guys made up quantum acupuncture right now off the top of your head, that's basically what this is. It's just a vague reference to quantum entanglement to explain the alleged magical effects of not just acupuncture, but some of the features of acupuncture that are particularly curious, right? So for quickie review, acupuncture is sticking needles into acupuncture points in order to manipulate the qi, right? The energy field in people. Now, qi doesn't exist, and acupuncture points do not exist. They are not based on anything real. No one has ever been able to demonstrate that they exist, that there is any underlying reality to them. And they're essentially based upon Chinese astrology. They are literally astrology. Initially, there were 365 acupuncture points, one for every day of the year, and they were based on the astrological calendar. And then over the years, they've expanded to like, now there's like 2,000 points. You can't stick a needle anywhere without hitting an acupuncture point, apparently. And there's no relationship. Oh, you put it in your left earlobe and it does this. You know, there's no physiological relationship to it whatsoever. And if you look at the published studies looking at whether or not acupuncture works, it doesn't. The systematic reviews show that acupuncture doesn't work. And by that, I mean that it doesn't matter where you stick the needles or even if you stick the needles. So sticking the needles in acupuncture points has no effect. There's only a non-specific placebo effect from just the ritual of the interaction, and that's it. Now, there are some elements to this that to anyone with any kind of medical experience should be able to tell you, strongly suggests that acupuncture is a placebo. And the authors talk about this. This is a key line. In the article, the authors write, it can be applied, it being quantum entanglement, right? Quantum entanglement can be applied to interpret the clinical situations, which is, this is loosely translated from the Chinese, I'm assuming, which is difficult to be explained in clinical practice, such as the instant effect of acupuncture, multi-point stimulation in one disorder, and the points with specific effects. So let's talk about the first thing, the instant effect. What does that mean? That means like you stick a needle in somebody and they instantly have their placebo effect, right? So that is actually completely independent of this paper and acupuncture or whatever. I could tell you as a being a physician for many years that having an instantaneous response to a treatment that is supposed to have a physiological mechanism is a red flag for a placebo or a psychogenic or a psychologically based response, right? Because physiology doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that quickly. There's very few things that would work so quickly to be perceived of as instantaneous. You know, things have to be absorbed. They got to go to their receptor sites. There's got to be some series of biological processes that happen that make the effect. And you just don't see instant effects. I remember this one patient, this is when I was a resident, This is the most extreme example of this phenomenon. They had weird neurological symptoms. We all thought that they were psychogenic, but we were giving them a treatment trial with a medication that they felt that they needed. And the patient had a dramatic resolution of their symptoms before the medication even worked its way through the plastic tubing and into their body.
Are you sure there wasn't any entangled electrons in the tubing, though?
Well, there you go. There was clearly a quantumly entangled distant effect from the medication. But that's exactly what they're saying. They're saying that, I know this looks like normally like it's fake because it's impossibly instantaneous. But in the world of quantum, it all makes sense. So this could explain this otherwise curious instant effect.
Yeah, decoherence be damned.
Right. We'll get more into that in just a second. The multi-point stimulation in one disorder. So in other words, how come different people can stick needles in different locations and have the same effect on the same disorder? Because it's not real. That's the short answer, is because none of it is real. But they're saying that, well, you could explain a lot with quantum. Now, where is this all leading? What the study actually was, it was not just a justification of quantum effects. What they were saying is that you could treat children by sticking needles in their parents. You don't even have to stick needles in the children themselves. Because, did you know this, Bob, that parents and children are quantumly entangled?
Decoherence be damned!
So this decoherence Bob speaks of, we talked about this before, and quantum entanglement is a very fragile, quantum phenomenon where particles that are created, in an entangled way, in a related way. Like if you have, the spontaneous generation of two particles that have, they have to have opposite spin. Yeah. Opposite spin, opposite momentum, opposite charge. So they all cancel out. They're entangled because the properties of one affect the properties of the other because they have to be opposite. But that entanglement goes away. It did cause decoherence, means that they lose the entanglement the more they interact with the environment and other particles. This is why you don't see it on a macroscopic level, like the level of people, because we're not isolated particles. We are
people,
masses of particles that are all interacting with each other in the environment. So they're massively decohered. There is no quantum entanglement. The idea that like a parent and a child are quantumly entangled is absurd. Oh, it's not quantum mechanics. It's magic. It's complete and utter nonsense. But I believe that sticking needles into parents is just as effective as acupuncture directly, because it doesn't work. None of it works. This reminds me of another study, which I think we mentioned on the show because it's just it's just too delicious not to. Phantom acupuncture. You guys remember phantom acupuncture? So there were now several studies. I went back and looked at the research, and I was reporting on, I think, the first one, but there have been a few studies now showing that if you do acupuncture on a rubber arm, mm-hmm. right, that is in place of somebody's real arm, they will get a full acupuncture effect off of it. Acupuncture works even when you stick it in a mannequin or a dummy or just a fake rubber arm.
Like you're actually getting the placebo effect.
Well, yeah. That it just shows that it's all placebo effect. It doesn't matter if it's your actual arm. There's clearly nothing physiological happening when you stick a needle into a rubber arm. But people respond to that sometimes as if it's like really happening because it's all placebo effect anyway.
Yeah. And it honestly, it does make sense because there are actually like a ton of neurological and psychological studies that show like phantom limb reduction by looking at a mirror at your other one, that show that like you can do certain things with mirror tests and like relieve itches and things like that. So I'm kind of not surprised that you're able to make that work in your head that way.
Yeah.
It just shows that it's purely psychological.
Well, doesn't this line up with what voodoo does as well with the voodoo doll?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Oh, that is basically acupuncture.
That's the first step in making a voodoo doll is quantumly entangling it with the target.
Exactly. That's why I only make my voodoo dolls out of superconducting material, and then I put graphene to make it better.
nice.
Yeah, that was for you, Bob.
I appreciate it.
There's probably a market that graphene voodoo dolls quantumly entangled with their target. There you go. You could market that. I probably shouldn't have said that. Let's give somebody that idea. But so, it's just like we talked about homeopathy when the researcher, Jacques Benveniste, was like, oh, look, the placebo homeopathy has the same effect as the quote-unquote real homeopathy. It must be transmitting the healing effect to the placebo. So let me wrap it in tinfoil. Oh, that didn't work. Let me put him in different refrigerators. That doesn't work. The placebo is still as effective as the active intervention. Then he went all the way to figuring out that he could transfer homeopathic healing rays over the phone, right? So there, nothing doesn't work. Everything you try works. You could do acupuncture over the phone. You could do it on other people, on dummies. It all works because none of it works because it's all placebo. The journal is Chinese Acupuncture and Moxibustion, right? That's the journal. And
they Moxibustion?
Moxibustion is when you like put a needle and then you burn incense on top of the needle, you know?
Moxibustion?
Yeah.
Wow. It looks so stupid.
Wow. It all does. It's like cupping. It's like it's all it's looks like medieval. It is all, ear can. It's all medieval.
Yeah.
Which is, in a way, an insult to medieval people, but.
At least they didn't know any better.
Right. Yeah. It is the exact equivalent of doing bloodletting today. Mm. In terms of it was superstition based from 1,000 years ago. And just, if you just modernized bloodletting, And in fact, cupping is bloodletting. Acupuncture was bloodletting. That's what they were doing. What do you think they were doing with those needles? They were bloodletting. It's
the
same thing.
At least with cupping, you get to keep your blood, I guess.
I don't think
it's so. Like it they moves around to a place it shouldn't be, but it's still in your body.
No. Sometimes when they do the, they sometimes will make an incision and squeeze the blood out.
Ugh.
What the hell?
Yeah, don't do that. Yeah. I mean, don't do any of it, but especially don't do that.
The worst thing about cupping, though, is that it leaves you with bruises that brand you.
Oh, yeah. They're huge, and they're all down your back.
Yeah,
I swear, the people that do it, like they seem to deliberately show them off, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think what we're thinking of, too, is like really high-level, very popular and famous athletes.
Yeah. Right.
So they get accolades for doing that. People are like, yeah, you're a badass.
Yeah, then everybody copycats them, right? All the high school swimmers or whatever.
Like kinesio tape, that stuff.
Is yeah, kinesio tape had its fed.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Cupping will have its couple of years. Yeah, but it kind of faded away. Remember, like, when that came out, that year we watched the Olympics, like, everyone had that kinesio tape on them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But to make everything better, Jay, we're all going to be flying in flying cars pretty soon, right?
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah.
So there was a recent study that had some very interesting things to say about flying cars. But first, they are called vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, or VTOL, V-T-O-L.
Yeah.
So that's if you like to talk in the parlance of the industry, you should say VTOL, and I'll probably be saying that throughout the course of what I'm about to tell you. So vertical takeoff is great because you don't need a landing strip, because how many people could have a runway, you know, and you can't just use the streets like in Back to the Future. You could take off going straight up. So you got to think of it kind of like a drone, like a drone that you could sit in. That's really what I think and what a lot of people think.
Yeah, basically what it is.
Yeah, that's what the flying cars of the future are going to be. You know, because historically, you know, they were just airplanes that could drive on the road in some manner or other.
Yeah, they weren't flying cars. They were driving planes.
Yep.
All right.
And, you know, we've joked in the past that everyone thought, you know, we were going to have flying cars decades ago. One of our friends, I remember Michael and Audrey were telling us, you know, they were teenagers in the 60s and 70s. And they were saying, you know, hey, we were sold on this whole idea that we were going to have flying cars, you know, like a lot of earlier generations really believed that we were going to have them a long time ago. And they still simply don't exist now for many serious reasons. I think one of the biggest factors is to be fuel efficiency and the danger, of course, you know. Today's driverless technology has definitely advanced making these more autonomous, which I think really is the only direction to go in, because you can't expect people to just be able to fly, you know, something in 3D. It's one thing to drive a car that's relatively 2D, right? You know, I mean, I'm not trying to be funny about that. But when you add that third element of altitude, that makes it so incredibly difficult. Plus, flying all by itself is a skill set. It's a very difficult thing to do. So, of course, we're going to need computers to help, if not do the whole thing. So what about fuel efficiency? Getting a craft off the ground takes a ton of fuel. And this is a really big consideration that this industry is trying to face, and a lot of scientists are looking into the details. Now, according to the study authors from the University of Michigan Center of Sustainable Systems and from the Ford Motor Company, it turns out that using a VTOL, the vertical takeoff and landing, for a short commute, it's not efficient. And what the study finds is that the longer the trip is, and if you have several passengers, it could end up being worth it. And they went into pretty extreme detail here. So when used in a traffic-heavy city or places where the geography causes travel issues, a VTOL vehicle could end up being pretty competitive or even outperform a ground-based car in regards to energy use and greenhouse gas emissions. So as an example, if you look at a map, if you wanted to drive from the city of Detroit in the United States to the city of Cleveland in the United States, you have to drive around the southern point of Lake Erie. So you just imagine having to drive around the finger of a lake. In this particular circumstance, it could take 3 hours to do the drive in a standard ground-based vehicle. It's 171 miles or 275 kilometers. If you took a VTOL as the crow flies, it's just about half the distance. And of course, there's no traffic. So that's 89 miles or 143 kilometers. Now, it's not just the mileage, because of course these flying vehicles can go 150 miles an hour. That's where they're at today. That's a lot faster than what you're going to be driving even at highway speeds. So the researchers found that for trips of 100 kilometers or 62 miles, a fully loaded VTOL, meaning it's carrying its maximum passenger carrying capacity, it has a lower greenhouse gas emissions than ground-based cars with an average vehicle occupancy of 1.5. So the emissions tied to VTOL were 52% lower than gasoline vehicles and 6% lower than battery electric vehicles, which is pretty amazing if you think about it. The transportation world, you know, the companies that are working on the future of transportation, they're poised to make these significant changes over the next few decades. And we want to make sure that the travel is, of course, safe. That's why, you know, the autonomous cars haven't come out yet, because of safety, that, you know, technology has to get, you know, past that initial safety mark and has to go into, it's a lot safer than humans driving. And of course, then we want to make sure the vehicles are using some form of renewable energy. And if they could reduce traffic and congestion and speed things up, that's even better. And that's what these flying cars were supposed to do. So several companies around the world are developing VTOL prototypes right now, and other companies like Boeing and Airbus already have prototypes, and NASA has even partnered with Uber to develop one. So this stuff is, you know, in the not too distant future. The researchers quantified energy usage and greenhouse gas emissions during the five phases of flight. So this is my favorite part of this whole thing. In a vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, there is takeoff hover, there's climb, cruise, descent, and landing hover, right? Without the clap. They found that the aircraft use a significant amount of energy during takeoff and climb, but when they got to the cruising, they're remarkably energy efficient. And this explains why longer flights are the best for the aircraft. And they can also fly about 150 miles per hour or 241 kilometers per hour. So a shorter trip, say that's about 35 kilometers or 22 miles long, you're better off driving in a single passenger gas-powered vehicle. That it's better than, of course, you know, flying a VTOL. And another interesting thing here is that most ground-based commutes are 11 miles or 17 kilometers. So people aren't usually driving that far for their commute on average. So the conclusion is that in most cases, vertical takeoff and landing aircraft are not more economical than ground-based vehicles, unless you're going for like the two circumstances that we said. If it's longer than 22 miles or 35 kilometers, if multiple people can commute in the same vehicle, and especially if there's any kind of situation where you need to fly over some type of troubling geography.
Jay, there's one other situation that they didn't explicitly mention. They sort of gloss over it. That occurred to me. It's like, well, what about with heavy traffic congestion? So even if it's 20-mile commute, but it, you know, L.A., New York City, big cities, it might take you an hour, 2 hours to go a very short distance because the traffic is so congested.
They said that.
But they didn't calculate cities. It. Yeah, they didn't. But I know, but they didn't give an explicit calculation.
Oh, yeah. I see what you're saying. They mentioned it, but they didn't do the. They didn't do the side by side energy.
Yeah, comparison. They glossed over it. And here's the other thing with that: if a certain percentage of commuters are flying over the traffic rather than being in the traffic, they'll obviously they might be cost effective and, you know, greenhouse gas effective because they're not sitting in traffic for 2 hours. But yep. also that's fewer cars. The traffic itself will be decreased. And so you have to calculate in the reduced gas burning of all the cars that are now in traffic for an hour and a half instead of 2 hours or whatever, you know?
Yep.
So the decongestion of the ground traffic. This study was very interesting to me because I was getting to the point where what I was reading was that like flying cars are never going to be economical because it's always going to cost more to keep something aloft than to roll it along the ground, which makes sense. But they're saying that actually cruising is not that bad. Once you get up there, if you have an efficient electric powered, you know, computer controlled flying car, it actually is not that inefficient. It's fine. And so as long as you don't make them fly too high, and, you know, in many situations, they may actually be cost effective and, you know, and environmentally effective. So that opens the door for, as you say, opening up some niche where they will mm-hmm. be used. And it might be that you won't own one, but there'll be an Uber-like service where if you have to go from Cleveland to Detroit, you call an Uber flying, you know, electric drone to take you. You get there much faster. There's fewer people on the road. And it's actually cost-effective to do that. So that makes me more optimistic for actually having flying cars in the future than I've been in recent years.
Yeah, me too. So to respond to what you said about the congested traffic, so a couple of things occurred to me while you were talking. One, that electric cars aren't really using any energy if they're just standing still because the engines can turn off.
Yeah.
Which is good. And on top of that, you know, once cars become more autonomous or truly autonomous, it's going to improve traffic, I think. I've read a lot of things about the improvement, not just of safety, but of overall the amount of flow that they can pass through today. Like, the, you know, New York City, as an example, is just clogged to death. But if every car was autonomous, it would be much more efficiently run.
Yeah. And even before they're autonomous, if they're just electric, like not only does my car not use energy when it's sitting still, but in bumper to bumper traffic, it puts energy back into my battery.
Mm-hmm.
Because braking actually.
Yeah, there's. It's great. Recover some of the lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you know, I'm sure that we're going to have solar panels on car roofs at some point. And if you're, you know, that's a factor, I think. I don't know how much, you know, one roof's worth of solar panel could collect, but still, it's better
than nothing. Put them on the charging stations.
I'd like mm-hmm. to fly in one before I go, Steve. How about you?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Absolutely. There's something else that was in the news that, you know, because Jay and I were talking about what item he should talk about. The other one that I thought was a runner-up to this very, very quickly is the UK's Sabre space plane engine.
Yep.
So this is a vision of science fiction, right, where you can take a spaceship from the ground and fly it into space, right? Single stage to space, but also like it acts kind of like a plane in the atmosphere, and then it just keeps going out into space. And then when you come back into space, you just land, right? There's no rockets. There's no stages. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no other components. So that's what they're trying to develop. The primary limiting factor is if you want like a jet to then rocket into orbit, but you need it to get high and really, really fast, right? You want to get as much velocity as possible out of the jet engine where the atmosphere, like the air, is your propellant before you have to go to your rocket propellant because there's just not enough air as you get too high. But the limiting factor is that those high speeds, the heat that's generated would melt the engine. And so the limiting factor is just cooling it fast enough. And that is what they're working on with the Sabre engine design. And the news is they just made a breakthrough in the engine design. And they were able to successfully quench 420 degrees Celsius stream of gases in the engine in 1/20th of a second. Oof. With their current design. They're using this like a pre-cooler filled with helium in order to, like, you know, basically the air is flowing over these cooling pipes. And then that worked. You know, they were able to do it. So they were able to demonstrate. So it's a proof of concept, you know, that this engine design could work. So we're probably still years, if not decades, away from having a space plane like this. But they're demonstrating that the technology is possible. And that would dramatically reduce the cost of getting into space, right? Because it's perfectly reusable and you're using much less propellant. And again, remember the rocket fuel equation, right? The rocket fuel equation is the math that dominates space travel. As Bob was talking about recently, that's why like you need more fuel than the universe to get places, because you need fuel to carry your fuel to carry your fuel to carry your fuel. So anything that reduces fuel or reduces propellant has a much magnified effect. That's why you want to get as fast and as high without propellant as possible before you kick in those rockets.
Steve, how does this differ? I'm trying to understand from the X-Core Lynx space plane, which apparently I just discovered today, X-Core went bankrupt and it's no longer being developed. But years ago, it seemed really, really, really promising. Like they had done a lot of raising of funds. I mean, I even did coverage for them. That's how I know who they are, because in a series, I was tasked with going there and interviewing their astronaut that they had on staff and all of the engineers about how this space plane would work. But this was rocket powered.
I think that was all rocket. That was just all rocket.
But the idea was that it took off like an airplane from a runway, went up parabolic and came back down and landed and could be reused.
Yeah, so it's like a scaled down shuttle, but it doesn't take off rocket vertically. It takes off like a plane. So it's using aerodynamics from the ground up, but it's using designed to use liquid rocket fuel, liquid hydrogen.
Yeah, liquid hydrogen. Yeah. And so why would that be not what you want?
Well, it could work, but the idea that then it's just harder, and this may be why the company failed, because you need more fuel because you're using propellant all the way. So the concept anyway is that it'd just be more efficient. You would need less propellant, because again, jets don't have propellant; they're just accelerating the air, right? Mm-hmm. They have fuel, but not propellant.
So this would need fuel and propellant?
Yeah, well, the rocket fuel is its own propellant, but it's still, you have to carry more of it, right? Because you have to be throwing the stuff at the bottom of the rocket.
And is it pretty expensive?
Well, it is, and but it's not just that. It's the rocket fuel equation, right? The more stuff you have to carry, then the more stuff, fuel and propellant you have to carry the stuff. It multiplies really quickly.
Gotcha. So it might not be scalable. I think this company, at least the Lynx space plane, their idea was one pilot and one passenger.
And it was suborbital.
It was really just for suborbital.
It was suborbital.
For tourism. It was basically, I want to see the curvature of space and then come right back down.
Yeah, you couldn't get into orbit with that. That's the problem. You need the space shuttle to get into orbit.
Gotcha.
But this is something that we want to get into orbit. You know, this is that's the idea, is we want to build the space plane that will get to orbit. But
isn't this kind of like the old ramjet technology concept?
Yeah, exactly. It's basically their ramjet. Yeah, that's what it is.
It has such a mid-century vibe to it, the term space plane. Like, it just sounds like a cartoon.
Yeah, but I think it will come back when the technology is working.
Yeah.
Hey, by the way, I had to throw in one point for Jay's first article. I have a standing bet with my wife from the year 2000 that we were all going to be driving flying cars in 2020 for $100. And
we're getting close, my friend.
Yeah, she keeps reminding me. She keeps saying, you got to do that in 1920, in year 2000 dollars. And I'm like, no. So anyway, optimism.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses Plus.
As you all know, we talk about The Great Courses Plus all the time. Why? Because they're awesome. Because when you go online, you can stream anything you want to learn about. They have a course on.
It's true. I mean, from black holes, you'll see why that's really relevant this week. You probably already know at this point. To the Italian Renaissance, you can even learn a new language. You can learn how to use a new camera. And they're all presented by experts who are passionate about what they teach.
Yeah, this week we're recommending the course, The Skeptic's Guide to Health, Medicine, and Media. Oh, that title sounds a little familiar. By coincidence, or maybe it's not, Harriet Hall actually wrote a review of this course on science-based medicine, and she absolutely raved about it, and I've been listening to it as well. This is done by Dr. Roy Benaroque, and he kind of really works He really walks you through his thought process on how to evaluate health claims, a lot of alternative medicine claims, for example, and decide whether or not they are reliable.
We know that you'll enjoy the Great Courses Plus 2, so and right now our listeners can start a free trial with unlimited access to the entire library. So start your free trial today. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, now, Bob.
Yo.
Before we get to your news item, remember last week we talked about the fossil record from the day the dinosaurs died, and I thought that was like the biggest news item of the year, perhaps. And now this week there are like two news items. I don't think either of them are that big, but
they're big.
They're big. There was another paleontological one. We found the another Homo species, right?
Apparently, yeah.
Yeah, apparently.
Bob wasn't paying attention.
It's still early.
No, I'm just a little skeptical that, because it's a few different unique characteristics. Oh, new species. You know, I think it needs a little more vetting, but it's encouraging and exciting, and I hope it's true.
I know. It's always a thing. Really, they can identify a new species from a foot bone, but you know what? Sometimes they can. They're saying is this was found in the Philippines. It's Homo luzonensis, and this is in a similar location to Homo floresiensis, right, on the islands in that region. So clearly humans populated this. And this was, I think, 70,000 years ago. So this was another species of diminutive Homo, so humans, at the same time as modern humans, again, on the islands in the same part of the world. But they say, yeah, so it's definitely a human foot bone, but it has characteristics that don't match any other human species. So it's got to be a new species of Homo. Right?
Yeah, that or it's got to be an individual difference.
Right, but that's the thing. You need multiple specimens from multiple individuals before you could say, yes, this is clearly a pattern here that we're seeing.
Yeah, but didn't they also see that the teeth, they collected five teeth from one individual, and those showed differences from the other hominids that they looked at?
Yeah, as is often the case with a new species, it has a mix of derived and primitive traits, right? Because they all do, because the branching lines are all weird. So it does. It's looking good. It's looking good. And they made a good technical case for it being a new species. But clearly, you know, the first salvo, unless it's like some other paleontologists were saying, yeah, talk to us when you got a skull, you know, something that's has a lot of features that, you know what I mean? But
well, and even one skull might not be enough. I mean, it could be a genetic anomaly. Like, didn't it take a really long time for floresiensis to actually be named?
Yeah, because again, that was the controversy. These are just diseased humans. Mm-hmm. But you need to have enough specimens to say, nope, this is actual species. But anyway, Bob, now you hit me with it's not paleontology, but this is a pretty huge news item. This is something we've been waiting for quite some time.
Yeah, it's an unforgettable day in astronomy news for sure. Today, I mean, and I love how it happened today, April 10th, 2019, saw the release of the first direct image of a black hole.
Wow.
Yeah, it's huge. It's not inferred, you know, from the gravitational effect or even gravitational wave detections. For all intents and purposes, seeing this thing. But isn't it invisible? Well, yeah, kind of. But this historic feat was accomplished by the Event Horizon Telescope Project, EHT. That project joined the forces of 200 researchers from 59 institutes in 20 countries and regions. I just love how these scientists from all over the world just work together and accomplish amazing things. The telescope itself is an international network of 8 radio telescopes scattered over the surface of the planet, each one synchronizing with the others, creating essentially an Earth-sized telescope with unprecedented resolution and sensitivity. This is called, by the way, very long baseline interferometry. Fascinating science. Shepard Dolman, the EHT project director, said, "We have achieved something presumed to be impossible just a generation ago. Breakthroughs in technology, connections between the world's best radio observatories and innovative algorithms all came together to open an entirely new window on black holes and the event horizon." So it really is a remarkable achievement. So the particular black hole we're talking about is from the galaxy M87, which is 55 million light years from Earth. This guy is this the black hole at the center is a whopper, 6.5 billion with a B solar masses.
Whoa.
It's gargantuan, but it's not gargantua. It's big. They also imaged the Milky Way, the Milky Way's black hole, by the way. That's called Sagittarius A star. It has what you might call a paltry 4 million solar masses, but it's much closer. It's obvious. It's only 26,000 light years away. This actually gave it a similar apparent size to the M87 black hole, which is a much bigger black hole, but it's much farther away. And it's weird how it kind of balances out. So yeah, their apparent sizes were very similar.
Bob, is that the picture that's more like U-shaped looking?
Yes, yes.
Okay. I saw a second picture, but it's not getting quite as much attention.
It's not, because it wasn't, because of various reasons, because, for example, Sagittarius A star is closer, it's smaller, and it moves around a little much. It's kind of not behaving consistently like the bigger one. So the bigger one just happened to create a much better image, and that's the one that they're going with.
No, what's funny, Bob, is that the picture of the black hole is like exactly what I imagined a picture of a black hole would look like. Isn't it,
really, Steve?
It's a glowing donut.
Yeah, it's, because it's like there's a hole, right? And it's inside of you're really imaging the swirling disk of material at the event horizon.
Yeah, but but what you're really seeing, though, is even more fascinating than that. So if you're some people may look at this fuzzy blobby image and they may be underwhelmed by the image. But I think that they're missing the gravity of the situation, if that's the case. So what are we seeing in this historic image? Everybody, look at the black hole right now. Okay? You're looking at the black hole. Mm-hmm. What do you see? So what you're seeing is a dark central area, right? And this kind of asymmetrical ring of brightness circling it. So let's talk about the middle area. That's the central shadow, or the blackness. It's obviously the business end of the black hole, right? That's the event horizon. It's not physical. It's just the distance from the singularity where nothing can escape, even light. If you cross that boundary, that arbitrary boundary, which basically is due to the gravitational pull of the singularity, you are not getting past it. You're not getting back out. As they say, all world lines inside the event horizon lead to the singularity. There's no way out. But did you know that the dark shadow is not just the event horizon? Like, say you're standing on the moon looking at the Earth, right? When you look at the Earth, you see half the Earth, right? The side that happens to be facing you. So you're seeing pretty much a half of the Earth. In actuality, the dark circle that you're seeing in that black hole image is 2.6 times bigger than the actual event horizon. So you're looking at something that's not quite what you might think. You might think, oh, you're seeing half of the event horizon because you're looking at it from one angle. But no, you're seeing a lot more there. So to try to visualize the structure I'm going to describe, imagine a bullseye, right? You've got a bullseye with concentric rings going outward. So the center area, a good chunk in the center, that's the true event horizon. But there's another dark ring around that event horizon, which actually maps to the back of the event horizon. So you're actually looking at the entirety of the event horizon, the front, the sides, the back, the top, and the bottom. You're looking at the whole event horizon at once because of the gravitational pull is bending the light. So it's showing you, the entirety of the event horizon. But it gets even more weird. So there's also light that goes around, any light that goes around more than once and then crosses the event horizon will also kind of be part of that shadow. So around the middle, which is the event horizon, and then the band around that, which is the back of the event horizon, then around that is another skinnier band of another image of the event horizon, and so on, like to infinity. I mean, there's like a countless numbers of images of that event horizon in that dark circle that you're seeing there. So
all in the hole of the donut.
That's in the hole. That's the hole. You're seeing multiple images of the event horizon. The true event horizon is in the middle.
But the reason it looks so big is because it's you're seeing it from basically all angles because of the way that it's being bent.
Yeah, right. The light's being bent in such a way that you're seeing all sides of the event horizon over and over and over. So there's the middle section. Now you've got the accretion disk, the light ring around the black hole. That's the famous accretion disk. swirling matter, superheated plasma. It heats up and glows while traveling eventually at relativistic speeds, going really, really fast around and around and around. And it just glows in X-rays, super bright. So one side, though, if you look closely, right, one side of that ring is brighter than the other one.
You don't have to look that closely.
Yeah, you don't. It's a little subtle.
It's pretty obvious.
I've seen models where it's much more distinct. And if you look at Sagittarius A star black hole, you can't even see one side of that ring. It's so dim. So what that is, what you're seeing is this is due to the, say, think of it as a Doppler shift. It's really called relativistic or Doppler beaming. So the light emitted from the gas that happens to be moving towards us in its orbit appears brighter than the other side that's receding from us at relativistic speeds, right? So if it's coming towards us, it's brighter. So that's the side of the accretion disk that's approaching us.
But there's no way to know which direction it's spinning.
Yeah, they know. They discovered that it's spinning counterclockwise. So,
whoa, so that's cool. Like now I'm having like a motion effect when I'm looking at the image.
Now, if you remember the gargantua black hole in Christopher Nolan's Interstellar movie, that image did not, his rendition of the black hole was supposed to be top notch, scientifically accurate. They they literally wrote scientific papers based on the research they did for that special effect in that movie. He left out that asymmetrical brightening because he didn't think the audience, it was necessary for the audience to see that and it would be a little confusing or whatever. But if you remember the Gargantua and Interstellar, it had an arc of light above, right? It had an arc of light above and below and through the middle. So what's going on with that? I mean, why did that happen? And that's because what we're looking at, this black hole M87, kind of like from near one of its poles. So it's it's kind of like at a right angle. If we were seeing it more edge on, then we would see that effect where basically you're seeing the back of the accretion disk, and the back of the accretion disk, the light is bent so that it makes a semicircle of light above the black hole shadow and below it. Right? If you can imagine the light leaving the accretion disk, it goes out and then gets bent towards our eye, so it creates that arc above and below. And at this point, I'll give a shout out to Katie Bowman. She was a grad student at the time, but she was responsible for some of the key algorithm that actually made it possible for this, for the first visualization of the black hole using the Event Horizon telescope. So kudos to Dr. Katie Bowman for her amazing contributions to this specific project and the other hundreds of researchers as well who made amazing contributions.
Bob, did you see the picture going around of her sitting at her desk when the image first came through on her computer? It's kind of amazing.
Yes.
She's like, oh, she looks like she's about to cry. Like, what a day.
Does it ever freak you guys out to think that 100 years ago, we didn't even know that there was other galaxies and now we're taking pictures of black holes?
It's amazing.
No, it's cool.
That was talk about expanding your horizons and like, oh wow, the entire universe isn't one galaxy. It's billions of galaxies. The only thing I could compare that to is when if we could ever prove that the multiverse exists, that would be much harder to prove, but amazing discovery. Yeah. If it
the
happens.
Mandela effect proves that, I thought.
The Mandela effect, right?
What's the Mandela effect?
That's when like people remember something wrong and they think that that's because it was in a different universe.
Oh, God.
Yeah, like the Bernstein Bears like that, versus Bernstein Bears.
Yeah, Bernstein Bears.
Yeah, how about you were just wrong?
The Shazam movie or something.
Yeah, the Shazam movie, exactly.
It's more likely, they think it's more likely that there is a multiverse than they're just simply wrong.
Yeah, no, I don't think anybody actually believes that.
No, there are people who actually
believe
it.
They are, You'd be amazed. You'd be amazed at what people believe.
So, Bob, I think we're having a contest here between paleontology and astronomy to see who wins the decade. I think we're going to have a vote next year. So,
I mean, gravitational waves and a black hole image.
That's pretty good, but we got the... we have a new species of hominid, a few species of hominid.
Yeah, but we already had a bunch of species of hominid.
Yeah, but there's not that many out there. And we have now the day the dinosaurs died, and we have Cambrian explosion, fauna. I don't know. It's pretty amazing.
I don't know. Talk to me, Steve.
Provincial.
Talk to me.
We will have to have a throwdown at the end of 2020 to see which
that all happened
wins
on
the decade.
Earth, Steve.
I know.
Steve, talk to me. Talk to me when one of those discoveries opens up a brand new branch of evolution or paleontology, like gravitational wave astronomy. It's a whole new branch of astronomy, a whole new window to the universe.
You mean, Bob, like DNA testing fossil bones? You mean like that? Like the Denisovans identifying a species by DNA? That kind of whole new branch of science?
No, that's still just genetics.
It really is. It's still just genetics. Yeah, but it was the application to paleontology. Like gravity's just gravity. All right.
Yeah, but we've never been able to use gravity.
Don't you think that Bob needs to calm down a little?
Gravity's just gravity.
It's not as cool as gravitational wave astronomy.
All right. Well, Steve, we talked about quantum acupuncture. Now you're going to tell us about a quantum engine.
Yeah, this is an interesting article, and when I read this, of course, I hadn't learned about new hominids and black holes and everything else that seemed to make this not quite as interesting. But it's the new quantum engine. The idea, and I love the science reporting, and you guys have talked about this a lot in the show, where what the actual science is, which is very interesting, and what is kind of depicted in the articles is a lot different.
It's a total bait and switch.
So the article talks about a new quantum engine, and it shows a picture of like a 57 Chevy's chrome engine. And it talks about how the new quantum engine is going to be more powerful and more efficient. So I'm just thinking that we're one flux capacitor away from a time machine. So the basic concept is using the laws of thermodynamics, we can increase the efficiencies that engines can theoretically produce. So there's something called a Carnot limit, which is the efficiency limitation based on thermodynamics of what an engine can do. And there's been some theories that we can use the quantum entanglement and coherence of different particles that would allow us to actually reach that limit or do further than what we can do what they call a classical engine, like your car can actually achieve. So the article then, you know, starts talking about how we can do this quantum stuff and relates it to car engines. The only difference is the car engine is the size of a car, and the structure that we're talking about is the size of an electron. So we're not really driving a 57 Chevy across town with one of these things. But what the scientists were able to do was actually pretty impressive. So it's a group out of UK and out of Israel. James Klatzow, Dr. Ram Uzin and then Dr. Elon Pohm. But what they were doing is this has been postulated back in 2015 that we could get these efficiencies using something called quantum coherence, which is the resonance of a quantum system, and it allows superposition and quantum entanglement to work. It also apparently allows you to have acupuncture from far away. And in this case, though, they're using a trick to, if you resonate between the high power and low power states, you're able to produce work that is far and exceeds the efficiency that what you're seeing out of a traditional two cycle or four cycle engine. And so what they showed in the lab was actually using a green laser, they could excite an electron and it would go into a high energy state. And then it would emit one photon that was red. And then they used a microwave to bring it down to the rest of the energy state, lowest, which is another red photon. So one green photon was able to exert two red photons out. And because they were able to do this and this gets kind of technical, guys, and I'm going to do a little quick stop. I don't know how technical you like to get on these things, and I don't want to spin the propeller and make everybody bored to death. So y'all shut me down if I start getting way too much in the weeds, okay?
Just talk about what you're interested in, and then I'll edit it down to whatever I think is appropriate.
Okay, that sounds good. Yeah, because I have a tendency to – I am a big-time a geek. I think my wife had the best thing. She put a T-shirt she gave me. It says, engineers aren't boring. We just get really excited about boring things. And that's kind of how I live my life.
I love that.
Yeah. I like it.
So what the key thing you can do with this is they showed there in a lattice structure of a diamond, you actually, it's one of the ways you can create qubits and quantum and, again, propeller head stuff. But you can put impurities of two nitrogen atoms instead of a carbon atom, and it creates a electron that is actually suspended in space. Now, you can change the state of that one electron using this quantum heat engine is what we're talking about. Green laser shoots it, goes into a higher quantum state. it goes down to a partial state, emitting a photon. A microwave gets it back down to the other state, the low energy state, and now you've started the engine cycle all over again. These cycles, one of the key things is to stay within the quantum coherence. It has to be less than 75 nanoseconds. So these cycle times are about 20 nanoseconds, and a nanosecond being a billionth of a second. So it's very, very quick, very, very small. But by doing this coherent state, they're able to actually set it into a space that the efficiencies is, they haven't been able to totally characterize what the efficiency is, but it looks like it could be at an order of magnitude over what you're getting out of traditional engines. You know, the problem is, how do you take the work out of this? And this is where I had to do research across articles and published articles, and you know, quantum physics, your eyes will start rolling pretty fast when you start reading about it. But what is important about this is I was able to glean, I don't know if you guys have talked about or looked at the fact that quantum coherence, you know, it may not work for acupuncture, but it is actually proven to be very important in photosynthesis.
Yeah.
And so the idea is that this quantum coherence is what allows the energy to be stored, allows the energy to be moved through the plant cycles. We don't still fully understand it, but this gets us one step closer to understanding how photosynthesis works. And from what this researchers are saying, you know, it's 5 to 10 years away. I think that's the standard answer, but it's that it actually could have a significant effect on photoelectric effect and photoelectric sales. So sales, man, that's my Texas accent coming in. Photoelectric sales is the fact that we can go in and that they can use quantum coherence. So a photon comes in from the sun and it was using green light, which is one that we don't normally use in the photoelectric effect. We could actually excite these electrons to produce heat or produce electricity using this quantum coherence and get a much higher efficiency from from this type of materials. So it does have some practical applications. It isn't going to make our 57 Chevy go any faster, but it actually does have a chance to create a very significant impact to renewable energy.
And so, Steve, they create this effect by shooting a laser at a diamond crystal, right?
Correct.
Have they tried using dilithium crystals?
No. Nice.
Yeah, that's
exactly. I don't understand that joke.
Yeah. So cute, Kara.
Sorry.
Add it to the list, Kara, of the things that you'll have to learn.
It's a Star Trek reference.
Right. Gotcha. Or I could have said Kyber crystal, which would have been a Star Wars reference.
Yeah.
But dilithium crystal is kind of more on point. Because then you could power starships with that shit, right?
That's right.
Probably what they're using right now is the quantum coherence of the dilithium crystal. But yeah, that's exactly, that covers what I had. Is there any questions or anything?
It is funny because it's a proof of principle of this physical, you know, property, right? That we can, you can exploit some of the principles of quantum mechanics to get more energy out of the breaking the classical limits, and that this is actually happening with things like photosynthesis, and therefore maybe this will make our solar cells better, whatever. But they present it as an engine, and then deep down in the article, you were like, yeah, the amount of energy being produced is so teeny tiny that it's not going to do any, it's not even going to charge your watch. You know, forget about that, let alone drive your car.
Well, and actually, like I said, this is what made me laughing about this is that in the article itself, it really hints at it, but it never explains what work is derived from it. And I literally had to go through three layers of articles down to the original papers before I could actually see that the work is minuscule, and they actually didn't even directly pull work out of it. They just inferred it based on what they saw from the electrical reaction of the system. Right. So there was no work actually derived from this, which means we didn't create any real power. But this is the first step. It proves the postulation that they did back in 2015. And I do see where this is going to, over probably decades, potentially have some pretty significant effects for some of the areas where this is going to affect. But yeah, the article itself, you didn't get that from any of the stuff you read.
Well, the welcome to our world, Steve. Right? This is what we do every week. For anything like even remotely technical like this, you have to go back to the primary article. And some are better than others. Some mainstream reporting does do a good job if you have a good science journalist. Others are like, they never tell you what's actually happening. It's all bad metaphor, you know? And right. You could never really figure out what they're actually talking about until you get to the original article. So you do often have to do that. All right. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Last week, I played this noisy. So there's something about Who's That Noisy that I've said a few times that I really love, and it's that so many different people hear so many different things. And a lot of times guesses make a lot of sense. You know, when we go through this exercise of hearing what people think it is, like there are kernels of truth in there, what they're hearing. So what do you guys hear?
I hear a puffin.
Anybody else?
Well, it definitely sounds like an animal, and it could be a bird, but it could also be like a frog. You know what I mean? It's just some kind of repetitive noise that an animal might make.
I don't know. To me, it sounds like one of those nerd shakies. Have you ever seen those things where you can shake the nerd back and forth and it makes a squawk?
Like a shake weight?
What? Yeah, my shake weight. I use that every day.
All right, so there are some guesses. Mark Hickson said, "Hi, Jay, this week's Who's That Noisy sounds very similar to the sound of a kookaburra." You know what, Mark? You were one of about 20 people who sent in that guess, and
no
it
way.
Is incorrect.
It's not a kookaburra.
Yeah, Mark Constantine also said that he thinks it was a kookaburra. Not correct, but, you know, I know that it does kind of sound like that because I listened.
It's more
Nick
dramatic,
Hilton,
though.
Nick Hilton said sounds like a penguin. Rick
a penguin.
Ree McKeon said, "Good day. I've listened for over 9 years. My first Who's That Noisy guess. Is someone trying to start a friction fire?" You guys know what this is? Like a bow drill? You ever see someone start a fire with friction?
Yeah.
That's a pretty cool guess. It's incorrect, but it's definitely like I can hear what he's talking about there.
Sorry, so you're 0 for 1. You waited 9 years to submit the wrong answer.
Yeah, keep submitting. It's okay to be wrong.
You don't have to wait another 9 years. You can submit another one.
All right, so guys, this is actually a baby bear. A baby black bear. Sleeping. Sleeping.
That's adorable.
Ready? Listen again. Listen to this. Isn't that adorable?
Are those lips flapping? What's happening there?
You don't see anything moving. He's just kind of snoring. and from what I've gathered, so this must be some type of animal rescue situation. The woman, I saw the same exact woman with two baby black bears in two different circumstances. The first time she's like, "Oh my God, this is adorable." The second time is, "I can't believe this is happening again." So under some weird circumstances, she got to hold two sleeping baby black bears, which I thought was pretty cool.
They are adorable.
That's an adorable noise.
Speaking of black bears, I remember how there was a black bear on my porch not too long ago. There have been further sightings of black bears in my neighborhood. So I think there's just one black bear roaming around our neighborhood looking for a place to hang out. You know, and we called the authorities. And they're like, "Yep, nothing we can do about it."
Yeah,
I love it.
Don't mess
Welcome
with them.
Welcome
them. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's his house too, man.
They're good friends.
So this week's noisy was sent in by a listener named Kate Brazel. And here is the noisy. How cool is that? What the hell is that?
That's
I'm going to give a
bear
clue.
Having a dream.
I'm going to give a significant clue because this is one of those data has been interpreted into noise sounds. And I give you that clue because I don't think anyone has ever guessed correctly when I play a noisy that is interpreted data transposed into music. It's so impossible to guess. It could be anything. And I thought I'd give you, like, anytime
fair.
Yeah, and I agree. I think anytime I play a noisy that's interpreted data, I should say this is an interpreted data noisy just so you have a, you know, you're not guessing, like, you know, is somebody like playing around with a turntable? You know, like, they're too hard. So if you think you know what this week's noisy is, or if you heard something cool, now, God damn it, I know you heard something cool this week. You got to email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, brother. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, the Rochester Institute of Technology.
Steve, you love the outdoors, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Well, so do the faculty and students at the Rochester Institute of Technology. And actually, they're not just walking around cutting trees down in their backyard like Steve does. They are observing short and powerful muscle movements of the common river trout. That's what they happen to be working on right now, which is awesome.
The team at RIT replicated those movements with elastomeric material, which is a super strong stretchy fiber that carries an electrical charge to create a fully submersible robot fish.
Robot fish!
Why? Well, researchers at RIT say the technology could lead to a new wave of prosthetics that help amputees regain fine motor skills.
It's absolutely fascinating, you guys. The team of creative engineering students is using design thinking and innovative technology to prove that at RIT, they're onto something life-changing. You can learn more about the project by visiting rit.edu/skeptics. That's rit.edu/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, couple of emails. Kara, this first one is a clarification.
Oh, my gosh. I love that even you, Steve, put OMG in the show notes for today next to it.
So what's going on with this Mexican wave?
You just
situation?
Want me to take it. Okay. Do you remember how off the cuff last week, like totally off the cuff, I mentioned that one of my very good friends who just so happens to be from the UK mentioned the Mexican wave in his Instagram stories. And I was like, what the hell is the Mexican wave? And then he was like, it's called the Mexican wave, isn't it? And I was like, not here. We just call it the wave. That sounds racist. And then he was like, crap, I hope it's not racist. And I was like, I don't know if it's racist, but maybe don't say it in front of a classroom full of Mexican kids when you're in San Diego.
Yeah.
So then we got probably more emails than we've ever gotten about anything.
It was nonstop.
I will say for the most part, the emails were almost exclusively from people in the UK, although there were a couple from people who are either from or currently live in Mexico. And for the most part, they were like, hey, I want to tell you about the origins of the Mexican wave. It definitely doesn't have racist origins, which is awesome. And I even think I remember, Steve, tell me if I'm wrong, because you edit it, right? So you hear it twice. I think I remember I was like, don't know what the origins are. If you know, let us know. I feel like I invited that email or those emails, which is great. And I really appreciated that. But I also got a handful of them being like, so in the last show, you said the Mexican wave is racist. This is why it's not. And I also can't imagine why you would even consider that it would be racist. So I sent a lot of emails back to those people saying, first of all, I didn't say it was racist. I said it sounds racist. And remember, I'm American and it sounds racist to my ears first and foremost. Because we just call it the wave.
You don't call it the Mexican wave.
Right? Yeah, like I literally never heard that phrase before. But then, of course, there's the argument of why tacking the word Mexican onto something, would that make it racist? You're the racist, which I think is a fair argument. You know, Mexican food is not racist. Coke is not racist.
It's the idea that it's gratuitous. Like if there's a gratuitous name attached to something that refers to a group, it just makes you wonder why you're calling it that, you know?
Sure, and that's part of it. And for us, again, because we've never heard it before, it's jarring. But you also have to remember that in America, there is a lot of entrenched racism, especially towards the Mexican and the Mexican-American population. Think about the wall that our own president has been trying to build for a very long time and how much, even from our own administration, we're constantly hearing dog whistles about South and Central America, but specifically, I think about the Mexican-American and the Mexican population because we do tend to have a higher percentage of Mexican immigrants. Also, there's a higher percentage of individuals who I don't think it's fair to even consider them immigrants because part of the United States was Mexico.
Yeah.
Like a big chunk of it was Mexico for a really long time.
They were literally living here before it was America.
Exactly. So I'm from Texas. I now live in California, right? I'm from two states where Mexican immigration is the highest and or indigenous, you know, Mexican individuals who live here, like you said, before America was even America and definitely before we drew those lines. So what I'm saying is that the reason that it's jarring and it sounds racist is because tacking that word onto things has been used to be racially insensitive for a really long time. And yes, it's true. It shouldn't be racist to say Mexican whatever. And yes, it's true that the origins of this term are really pure. And now I know that because of all the great emails that this was.
Yeah, the World Cup in, I think it was 87, was in Mexico. And that was essentially Europe's introduction to the wave. And because it was in Mexico, they've always called it the Mexican wave, which is fine. And that is not a racist origin for that term.
Yeah. So it actually was endearing. Like people were like, this is great. That's why they still call it the Mexican wave. Although apparently some of the emails I got were like, it might not have actually started there.
It was when it came to their attention. Yeah,
exactly. And other emails were like, yeah, but it's there's nothing particularly Mexican about it anymore. So it is kind of weird. But it's interesting to me that almost every email I got was from somebody in the UK. So it was either Ireland. Most of the emails were Ireland, Scotland, England. And they were almost all like, I don't understand why this would be racist. And it's like, because you're not American and you don't have the same shared cultural history.
Yeah, but you think like our American listeners are like, yeah, that's racist. You know, I think that's what their reaction was.
I think a lot of people that I've mentioned it to were like, that sounds racist.
If you don't know the origins.
Yeah, it just sounds racist. And it's funny because one person wrote in and mentioned the Irish car bomb. And I was like, holy crap. Like, we call this drink an Irish car bomb, which is, that actually is like legit racist. But I'm sure it sounds extra racist if you live in the UK, right? So there is this kind of, you do have to remember the shared cultural history, all of the entrenched racism that exists, and all of those historical concepts. But I do like that a handful of people were like, in the English-speaking world, it's called the Mexican wave. And I was like, no, in your English-speaking world, it's called the Mexican wave. Not in our English-speaking world. Maybe in some commonwealths, I'm not sure. But almost every email came from the UK. So that was definitely an interesting
cultural thing,
gestalt there.
Yeah, and one thing I'll throw in on this is, you know, I said my daughter is a senior in high school. And I find like we're hypersensitive to ever using a nationality to describe anything. You know, I'll even just say, you know, my son, he was out with his Filipino friend. And you're like, well, you can't say that. I'm like, well, that's like, there's no,
you can say
no
Filipino friend.
Well, but in that case, like, why are you identifying him as that? You know, because, but I'm saying that's the world that these kids, these Gen Zs are. Whatever you're saying, no matter how you're just trying to clarify, they're like, because you're trying to put specificity to something, they have a tendency to immediately jump on that's a racist way to look at things.
Like a Mexican person, it's not racist to say somebody is a Mexican person, just like it's not racist to say black or African American. What's racist is to call a group of people blacks. Like there are these nuances in language, but
yeah, if you say the blacks, that's totally different. Like,
if somebody's like, wait, who's Joe in down the hall? And you're like, oh, he's the black guy who's in office 3. Like people be like, oh, now I know the identification of Joe.
Right. That's not racist.
But it's funny. But like I said, for the kids, the high school kids, the Gen Zs, they're so hypersensitive that they just – there's a lot of pushback to say, yeah, this is – you're trying to identify or stereotype or categorize somebody when it's – there's nothing negative going on in your own mind. But they want to be
category blind.
I think the issue that you're talking about here is an idea of intersectionality, an idea oftentimes of people who are biracial or multiracial who don't want to be labeled as something. This happens a lot. One of my best friends is Afro-Caribbean, and people call her African-American all the time, and it drives her crazy because she's from Panama. She's like, I'm not African-American.
Not American.
Yeah, and that happens a lot, right? So if you were like your Filipino friend, and he was like, I'm actually not Filipino, I'm like from Singapore, like that would be
insulting. Well, that happens a lot. That happens a lot with people from Asia. You're like, oh, yeah, exactly. My Chinese friend, I'm Korean, hello.
Yeah, like, hi.
Because we don't know the difference, yeah.
But if somebody is Filipino and they have a proud Filipino heritage, exactly. If they self-identify as Filipino, I actually think that, like, quote-unquote race-washing that is quite dangerous and it's actually not respectful. So, yeah there's a lot. It's like when people say I'm colorblind or people say I'm gender blind, or it's like, no, you're not. That's bullshit. That's just a way to get away with not wanting to respect these people.
It's a complicated issue.
That is my soapbox. I will get off of it.
Let's do one more email because this is a really great question and the answer is very interesting. This comes from James Schaffer from Minneapolis, who writes, Long-time listener, first-time questioner. Today I came across this article on NPR, and then he gives a link, suggesting that banning plastic bag usage in favor of paper and reusable canvas bags is actually worse for the environment.
What?
What do you guys think about that? So I did some research, and I read the article that he linked to. So, Kara, how would you respond? Do you think that using plastic bags...
People will buy more. I saw it in there, right? That if you stop using single-use plastic from the store, and most people actually do reuse those bags, that then they're somehow going to buy more trash bags.
Yeah, so that's not the whole issue. That's
okay, good. Because if that was the only issue, I'd be like, that's a bullshit argument. These are growing pains. It's part of the process when you phase things out.
Yeah, so that's an issue, but there's a deeper issue here. And this is, the question is, if you do this life cycle analysis, right? We've been talking about this, that you can't just take a simplistic approach to anything, any change that we try to make to help the environment or to reduce our carbon footprint or reduce garbage or whatever. You have to consider the whole system and how this will impact how we do things. And when you do that analysis, you actually find that the story of plastic bags is much more complicated than you might think. So first of all, the fact is it's actually cheaper and environmentally, the environmental impact of one plastic single-use, you know, bag that you would take food home from the grocery store is a lot less than paper bags or any of the reusable bags.
And that's based on everything.
So
you're saying one-to-one.
It costs energy to make the paper that you put in the paper bag. And if you count all the energy it goes into making that, it's actually less than the amount of energy and the carbon footprint of making that plastic bag.
Yeah, but one-to-one, right? So like a reusable bag, you reuse. That's the whole
point. Well, yes. So the question is, how many times would you have to reuse a certain kind of bag in order for it to be environmentally equivalent to just using single-use plastic bags for those many times? And so it's more than you might think. Yeah, so if you use a tote bag, it would only take 131 times. The best are plastic reusable bags, like the heavier plastic reusable bags are probably the most environmentally effective thing you could use to bring food home from the grocery store.
Well, my multi-use plastic bags are made out of recycled plastic bags.
Yeah, that's right. But you still have to
recycle
reuse
plastic
them.
Bottles.
You do have to reuse them tens of times, hundreds of times to really make a difference.
But that's also, are you looking on both ends? Because I just want to be clear. You're not just looking on the production side. Okay, so you're looking at the production side, but you're not looking at all of the pollutants of single-use bags going out there.
You're right.
Well, huge.
Yeah. So we're just looking at the environmental impact in terms of like the carbon footprint. The plastic bags are actually better until you like significantly reuse your bag. So just like reusing the bag once as your pooper scooper or whatever, it's fine, but it doesn't make up for the fact that they're still cheap.
And the thing is, the better the quality, the more uses you're going to get out of it. And now you have the opportunity when you're going to buy a reusable bag, one that folds down, that fits in your purse, that fits in your car, whatever, or multiples, buy ones that are made out of post-consumer plastic.
Right. You can
so
do that as well.
So it's double duty. Yeah, that's what I do.
Right. Using single-use paper bags is worse than using single-use plastic bags. Most people don't realize that. So banning plastic bags a lot of the articles are written about, should we ban plastic bags? But you have to consider, what's the alternative? What are people going to do? If you go to paper bags, it's actually worse because most people are going to use them as single-use. And if you go to reusable bags, it depends on what kinds you buy, and people have to use them hundreds of times to really get the advantage out of it, which you can do. I use, you know, reusable bags that I've been using for years. I go shopping every week.
Yeah.
So I've used them hundreds of times by now, but that's the level that you need to get to. These are your permanent bags, you know, or at least very, very long time, very, very long term.
But I do feel like, okay, two things here. You cannot ignore the horrific impact of plastic pollutants.
Yeah. So that's the other angle to this. And then all of them say that even though it may be have a less of a carbon footprint, it still is going to be the environment for 400 years. So from a pollution point of view, the plastic bags are still worse. because they're not biodegradable.
They're way worse.
Yeah, a paper bag is going to break down. Yeah. So even there. And the truth of the matter is what we're talking about is social change. Like we're talking about trying to change institutions so that people develop psychological habits. And I'd be interested in a study, and I bet you they exist, but I can't cite one right now, in a study that shows that people who reuse bags or people who carry glass or metal straws probably are likely more conscientious in other aspects of their consumption as well.
Yeah, one would imagine. So the articles are good, though. I think the articles that I'm referencing, I'm just looking for articles on this topic, and the ones that I came up with were all fairly thoughtful. Some were, I think, a little bit simplistic, but in the way that you're saying. But most of them said, yeah, the solution here is not just a simple ban or to say, you know, that the plastic bags are bad and everything else is better. You have, if you consider everything, then what's clear is that people need to change their behavior so that they're using reusable bags for a long time. That's really the key. You can't just go to paper and think, oh, you're saving the world, or you can't like buy a reusable bag and use it 10 times and throw it away or lose track of it or whatever. It's the reusability here is the key. That's the feature that we need to go for. But also, because yeah, that also means you're throwing a lot fewer things out, which is critical.
For sure. Yeah, because like the idea of throwing a reusable bag away, like people just don't do that psychologically unless it's broken.
Yeah, they break. You know what I mean? They break and you throw them out. Yeah.
You know, the thing that bothers me about this is that it's obvious that we need to be using products where you're just reusing it. Like Kara carries around metal straws with her, right? I don't use straws. Yeah.
I just don't use straws. I don't use straws.
Yeah, that's
I
also
just drink
good.
Out of the bottle. Yeah.
But, you know, like my wife and I have the bags that Steve has. You know, I went one day, I was at the supermarket, and I'm like, oh, cool. Like they have these like, you know.
These green bags. Yeah.
These green bags. They're great. They work. I've been using them for years. Like why isn't everybody using these? Why is it so difficult for adoption? Like, you know, you were saying,
Well, because Kara, you're not forced to.
Yeah. Well, I tell you guys, the thing that I've always found to be is like I said, it's the constant reminder that'll get people to change. And I've been a big fan of what they've done in a lot of places. I was just in Boulder with my daughter, where she's going to go to school. They charge you 5 cents if you want a bag.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, and that's what they do in California too. Well,
and I'm always like, you know, it's like when I go to a store and I buy a candy bar and a Coke, and they keep wanting to give me a bag. I'm like, no, I don't need it. I'll just carry it out. And if there's a little charge for it, people will start to change their habits. They won't accept a bag if they've got three items, or they'll start bringing in reusable bags, even if you and charge it for both paper and plastic.
We charge for both in California,
and I think it'll slowly start to get people's minds, you know, because the money, it's not just the money, it's the thought, you know, why are you charging me money? Well, because this is bad for the environment. And it's a tax. It's a tax, and it's also making it's almost like a reminder. And I think that over time will have some impact on people's daily lives. And it's not going to be an overnight. If you legislate it down, people are just going to rebel against it. But if it's something that if I want to have this bag, I'm paying the 5 cents or the 10 cents.
But that's legislative, though. That's the thing.
Not a banning, though.
So in California, we have both. We have the legislated tax or charge, and we've had that for like bottles for ages with redemption. And
we have
like
that too.
In Los Angeles, we have the actual ban, and both those things work together in synergy. But also in Los Angeles, we voted for that ban. So the majority of people wanted that ban.
All right, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. But this week, our guest rogue is going to do science or fiction.
Woohoo!
So Steve offered, I'm like, yeah, hell yeah, I'm covering the inpatient server this week. I don't have time to do science or fiction. This is perfect timing. But this is a little twist. You're going to put your own little conspiracy twist on this. Tell us what you're going to do.
Yeah, I thought it would be fun, especially with you guys all being skeptical experts, that I said at the opening of the show, I've been doing a lot of research on different conspiracies. I've got to be on every government watch list for all of my browser history. But so I thought it'd be fun to take a couple of the – one of the things about the conspiracies that's interesting is you find that some of them are actually real. And then some of them are what you think they are, which is BS. So I've got three news items. Two of them – they all sound conspiratorial. Two of them are actual science, and one of them is a conspiracy. And I'm going to see if the panel of skeptic rogues can actually figure out which is which. All right. So you guys ready for this?
Let's do it.
So item number one, a big pharma lobbyist was secretly behind the study that showed the five-year survival rate for Gerson Clinic. All right. Let me start one more time. Item number one, a big pharma lobbyist was secretly behind the study that showed the five-year survival rate for Gerson Clinic cancer patients was only 10%. Item number two, during the Cold War, Canada developed a machine to identify gay men who were illegally working for the government. And item number three, the U.S. military has developed and successfully deployed technology that can change the weather. All right, Dr. Novella, since you're not hosting this, I'm going to let you go first on this.
All right, so the first one about big pharma lobbyists being behind a study, that's so common. If that isn't real, then you crafted that one to get me, because that is very common for some things like that to happen. The second one about Canada developing machine to identify gay men who were illegally working for the government. So the Cold War spans of the right time in history for, you know, where there was a lot of homophobia, but they developed a machine. That sounds kind of dodgy. And then the third one is the U.S. military developed and successfully deployed technology that can change the weather. Yeah, I mean, I remember reading about stuff like this, I think this one's going to come down to, what do you mean by change the weather? We certainly can't control the weather, but doing things to like increase the probability of it raining or not raining or whatever is not out of the question. So I'm going to, even though that one's I think that's the gotcha one, I'm going to say that one's probably correct. And I will go with the gay machine as the fiction.
Okay. All right. And Bob, since you
wait. I have to ask, though. Did they call it Gaydar?
Oh, God.
All right. Hey, since Bob, you got the black hole news item that made your week, so you get to go next.
Okay. Thank you. Let's see. The big pharma lobbyist. Yeah, I mean, that's true. But what is this Gerson Clinic thing? Am I supposed to know what that is?
It's a homeopathic clinic that has an alternative cure for cancer.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that one. Let's see. Jump to three there. Yeah, the change the weather. Yeah, I mean, yeah, Steve kind of nailed it. What do you mean by change the weather? I mean, just by walking down the street, you could, you know, you could change a chaotic system like weather. Yeah, the thing is, though, you never know. You can't specifically change it for a desired end because you never know what's going to happen. It's too chaotic and unpredictable. But so, yeah, so I think you can you know, increase the odds of changing the weather in a favorable direction. That's not too crazy. And I had a similar reaction to the machine. Why would they care if they were illegally? Would they care if they were homophobic? Would they care if they were legally working for the government as well? But yeah, the idea of this of some type of machine is kind of drawing my attention to that one. So I'll say that one's fiction as well.
Okay. And Jay?
Yeah, I was kind of following the same track as everyone else. I mean, I definitely think that the U.S. military developing the technology that can change the weather, that's probably real. I mean, lots of different countries have tried, and, you know, there's been, you know, you read things that China was doing. Yeah, the weird thing about the second one here, about Canada developing a machine to identify gay men, I'm just thinking about, like, what could the machine possibly be? Like, is there, you know, this is going to be sound stupid, but are there any kind of biometrics or something that they were measuring?
Well, he didn't say it worked. He just said that they developed one.
Yeah, but I'm just trying to think, you know, even though it could be complete bullshit, what were they going for? I'm going to say that I think that the first one about Big Pharma is fake.
Okay, so... And then finally, Kara?
I think I might be going with Jay on this one. So, I mean, honestly, I think you wrote these really well because these could all be true.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I like, definitely followed Steve's blueprint on how to write these article names.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in my view, I think that none of them sound like conspiracies. So the U.S. military developing and successfully deploying, my guess is something like cloud seeding.
Yeah,
you know,
right,
that you can cloud seed. Yeah, so that's my guess. During the Cold War, Canada developing some sort of machine. Who knows if it works, whether it's – we do have a machine that you can like put in somebody's penis and then make them watch like sex tapes and see how much rigidity it gets. It's crazy. Like, I don't think they could do that to government employees, but even like some version of a lie detector I could see them developing. And the way I read this, Bob, which is different than the way you read it, is that it was illegal for gay men to work for the government.
Yeah, that's how I read it too.
And so they were trying to identify basically men that weren't out, who were hiding their sexual identity so they could maintain their government jobs. And makes I'm not surprised. Sense. During the Cold War, like, homophobia was still rampant. And then a big pharma lobbyist was secretly – that's the one thing that's getting me on this. Maybe – I mean, I know, Steve, you said that this happens all the time, but I also thought that it was pretty common practice at this point that you have to disclose your relationship. Oh, I'm reading this as big pharma, like – I'm a conspiracy theorist, and I'm like, big pharma just wants to poison us when really big pharma makes good medicine that's important. And so they are like, hey, we're going to fund a study, and it's going to show that this homeopathy clinic is crap and that they should be people should be taking our drug because it actually saves lives. So that's why that one seems true, too. But I think the thing that's getting me on it, Jay, and why I'm going to agree with Jay, is that I wonder if it wasn't a secret, that this was just all out in the open. So I don't know. We'll see.
Okay. So, Kara, you're going to go with number one?
I'm going to go with number one. So you're split.
We're
and
split.
Nobody picked the weather one.
Right. So let's take these in reverse order then, and we'll start with the first one. So the article is, the U.S. military has developed and successfully deployed technology that can change the weather. And again, the key, successfully deployed.
Oh, crap.
but this is actually science. So, this actually is pretty interesting. And Steve, you did nail this, and Kara, you mentioned this too. Cloud seeding is the technology. Yeah. So it's changing, not creating weather, unlike the conspiracists who claim like HAARP up in Alaska can actually, you know, create hurricanes and stuff. This was done back in from March of 1967 to July of 1972 in Vietnam, the Vietnam War, where they were trying to extend the duration and the intensity of the monsoon season. The pilots that flew the missions actually had the motto of saying, make mud, not war, and which I thought was pretty funny. But anyway, so this was proven. They did stop the operation. But, you know, since then, Saudi Arabia has used cloud seeding to create rain. China used it during the Olympics to get more snow. So it's a technology that's actually well known. But again, it's not as nefarious as a lot of the conspiracists want to say, where they're creating major weather patterns. It's just exacerbating the materials that are already there. So you all got that one right. So let's go to item number two, which is, during the Cold War, Canada developed a machine to identify gay men who were illegally working for the government. And you guys are right. During the Cold War, apparently being gay and being a communist were exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. But, you know, the idea of developing a machine to do this, by the way, Kara, the device you described is horrifying, and I didn't know that something that terrible existed.
They use it, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's the tumescence. Studies. It's called the tumescence test. They want to know if you get hard from gay porn, basically.
And we found that some of the people, many studies have replicated that the most entrenchedly homophobic people tend to actually have
that's a whole nother episode to talk about.
Exactly.
But anyway, so the this item is science. Yes, it is.
Yeah, it's actually Jay.
The Canadian, and you guys did hit on some of the points. So the name for the project they had was called the Fruit Machine.
And, oh my gosh! No.
I didn't name it. It's what it was, and the idea was they were trying to ferret out any gay men who were working, because they were going to overturn the government and make it a gay communist place. And so they contracted a guy from Frank Robert Wake was the scientist who built this machine, and it looks and acts eerily like the machine. If you remember the original Blade Runner, what they'd used to find the androids, where they look at the eye dilation and perspiration and. That's what they built. So Blade Runner is kind of a thing, but they couldn't get in a lot of test subjects, because the first ones they said it was to just rate stress, And then as soon as people realized that the machine was supposed to find if you were gay, like nobody would be a test subject because they didn't want to get right. And it's all based on more stereotypes and bad science versus actual fact. It was all, well, obviously a gay man is going to see a half nude man and he's going to dilate his eyes and which is ridiculous. But that's what they were using. They did abandon it in 1967. They actually destroyed all the prototypes because I think the Canadian government was just embarrassed about it happened. But that is actually science. If you look up the fruit machine, you'll see what it's about. And so that all means that Kara and Jay, you guys were right. The Big Pharma lobbyist is the fiction. Everything about this is a fiction. But it's not the actual truth is even worse. So it wasn't Big Pharma lobbyists that did a study of the Gerson Clinic. It was actually some naturopaths that that visited the clinic. And they went and found out that the survival rate was only actually 5%. And the one person that was still alive was on hospice. It's interesting. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got to talk about this. Like, this is the kind of data that I did put into my game because I want people to be aware of the dangers of some of these homeopathic remedies. And so if you go search the Gerson Clinic and their stuff on the internet, it took me forever to find this. Everything is all about these fake studies that are showing it works when it doesn't. But the Gerson diet is basically an organic diet. Then they pump people full of B12 and then they do five coffee enemas a day. What happened was is that so these naturopaths in 1983 went there and they said, okay, well, let me see your stuff. Well, what Gerson Clinic does is so people come in, they give them all this vitamin B12. The coffee has caffeine. They got on an organic diet. They start feeling better and they go, you're cured. They walk out the door. They never talk to them again. And they just put another checkbox in the cured column.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the other thing they don't do is they don't pre-qualify that people actually had cancer when they got there. So they could say this person been cancer free for 20 years after the clinic, but they never really had it in the first place because there was no diagnostic test done.
Right.
So these naturopaths went out and they were able to track down 21 of the patients that were supposedly cancer free, and they found 20 of them were dead and one was in hospice. And so I find it interesting though that naturopaths, which are into this homeopathy stuff, were the ones that actually did the definitive study. They've done other studies where like Gerson Clinic presented 149 cases to the researchers. Only 27 of them actually had medical data. And of that, they weren't able to find any real effects from even the data. And this was the cherry picked cases that the Gerson Clinic had provided. So this is definitely the fiction. 10% would be a huge upswing from what they're actually getting for 5-year survival rates. And that's it. So
Good job.
Thank you very much.
Great job.
All right.
That was really I totally hard. Misread that one. I read it too fast.
Story of our lives, Steve.
I know. I'm hoist on my own petard. If I had read, I didn't even make the connection to that. Now I know what the Gerson Clinton. I didn't make the connection. Now that you say, I remember that whole
it's
story.
It's probably my Texas accent that screwed
up. Yeah, but good job. So, Jay, do you want to cover the quote since Evan's not here?
I have a quote, Steve.
All right.
All right, this is a quote from Jules Verne. Reality provides us with facts so romantic that imagination itself could add nothing to them. And of course, like I said, this is a quote from Jules Verne.
I think that's appropriate given this episode. I mean, we have a picture of a black hole. What's more awesome than that?
That's right.
Amazing.
Right? Except maybe fossils from the day the dinosaurs died.
Don't get your hopes up. Jeez.
All right. Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us on the show this week.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. This was a blast. I really enjoyed this.
I'm glad you had a good time. And don't forget about all the upcoming cool events we have. Take a look at our website. Jay, when's the new website going live?
So soon, Steve.
Yeah.
You know how these are. We've been a week away for a month.
Jay, we've been a week away for like 6 weeks, 6 months.
5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's we're really like we're at the end now. We're right. So damn close.
You said it now on the show, so I want to see the new website within a week. But yes, we'll let you know when that goes fully live. We're gonna have some cool stuff there. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
You too, brother.
Sure, man.
See you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Huzzah!
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions. dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.